Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Episode 41 of The Bowery Boys. The New York Post.
Hey, it's The Bowery Boys.
Hey.
The Bowery Boys is brought to you by Eurocheapo.com. Eurocheapo editors personally visit and review the best budget hotels in Europe. Now with hotels in New York City. On the web at Eurocheapo.com.
Hello there, and welcome to The Bowery Boys. My name is Greg Young.
And I'm Tom Myers.
And this week, we are talking about journalism, New York journalism, and one of the rocks institutions of the city, the New York Post.
The old
Post.
Gray lady.
No, not the gray lady. The maybe kind of crazy lady.
The crazy lady of New York journalism.
But, I mean, as you know, like you just said, it's an institution. It's the 13th oldest newspaper in the United States.
And the New York Post is the oldest continuously published newspaper in the United States.
And it's one of the only newspapers that I know of that actually starts with the founding father and, you know, still runs today and is one of the most eye-catching pieces of print that you can get for a quarter in this city, definitely.
One of the only remaining pieces of print you can have for a quarter. The only paper I know that puts page 6 on page 10.
It's a paper we all love and we all love to hate. We're going to look at it specifically through the owners of the paper. We'll be mentioning an editor and writer here or there, but mostly it's the owners who kind of set the direction. And this paper does go in some wild directions, zigzags back and forth, like with political affiliations and partisanship.
So today we'll be going back behind the headlines, looking at the real story behind the New York Post.
Stay tuned. All right, Tom, I just happened to be holding a New York Post, a late city
you
final.
You do, look at that.
And the particular headline, this is not that sensational in terms of crazy words or outrageous phrases, but it's for the history of Yankee Stadium. I think they listened to my podcast a couple weeks ago.
They must have,
but
yes.
It's a wraparound cover. It's very special.
Collector's edition.
You know, for people who don't live in New York, they may not, you know, they don't regularly come across a Post because I don't think it gets distributed across the nation.
Well, it does show up in some big cities. Okay. You can buy it in L.A., and you can buy it even in eastern Pennsylvania.
Why don't you give us a little outline of what the New York Post is?
Are you asking me to situate the listener?
Situate, yes, please.
Can I hold the Post?
Yes, there you go.
Here we go. I'm holding a New York Post. It has 84 pages. It is a daily newspaper, originally called the New York Evening Post. Today, as you can see, Greg, this paper is in a tabloid format.
Yes.
As opposed to a broadsheet. This format is called the tabloid side, as opposed to the style, the sensational style of journalism that we call tabloid. Yeah, this is... When we say tabloid, we're talking about the style, and I guess in the case of the New York Post, you're talking about both.
This is tabloid in every sense of the word.
Right. The Post today is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, and it's part of his whole global empire of newspapers and television channels.
Fox and everything.
Fox and all of the papers in the UK and in Australia. The paper costs 25 cents on weekdays, 50 cents on Saturday, and... only a dollar on Sunday when it's much larger. The circulation is impressive. 725,000 people approximately get it on the weekdays with 439,000 on the weekends, making it one of the very most read newspapers in New York. And you can compare that to the Daily News, which has a circulation roughly the same. I mean, the last numbers I saw were 718,000. The Times has a circulation of 1,120,000.
A little bit more, okay.
Yeah, significantly higher, but that's also the national circulation. And as you pointed out, the Post isn't readily available in other parts of the country.
Well, and also when you're like on a subway or a bus, it's just easier to read the Post in terms of the size.
And it covers all kinds of news. I mean, international, national, local. But it also, I think it's best known for its coverage of celebrity news, gossip, It's got a great media section, business news, and a very, you know, well-loved and respected sports section.
Right.
And where would, you know, the New York gossip scene be without its Page Six, which mm-hmm. covers all kinds of, you know, we've heard blind items.
Yes, seen here, seen there, right.
The Post today is also famous for its eye-catching photos and its kind of over-the-top puns in the headlines, which are just really great. I mean, they really keep the New York punsters in business, you know?
Well, I mean, it's the only paper where the actual headline can get people talking about the headline and not the news style behind it, you know?
Sometimes they take a little deciphering, too. And the Post editorial page is decidedly conservative in its slant.
What's funny about the Post is, considering what it is now, how it really got its start. I mean, it started with the founding fathers. As a matter of fact, you can even say the birth of the New York Post happened because of Thomas Jefferson being elected president in 1800. Is actually kind of the spark.
Okay, you're taking us back.
Yes, we're all the way back. Now, I don't know if you remember this election in 1800, mm-hmm. but it was a very contentious election. Thomas Jefferson's party, the Democratic Republicans, they swept the Federalists out of office. One of the people who were swept away, basically, in terms of their power, was Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton, who in his biography that Ron Chertow wrote a few years ago, calls him the patron saint of the New York Evening Post, and I'll tell you why. So when he left Washington's cabinet, because he was on his George Washington's cabinet, he still had influence on John Adams' cabinet. Once Jefferson was president, he really had no power. He was basically a has-been. So he watched as a lot of the laws and things that he had done were overridden by Jefferson. So basically, because Hamilton needed an outlet, and he thought the Federalist Party still needed some way to get its opinions out there so that Jefferson wouldn't remain unchecked. So he started the Evening Post as kind of his own personal sounding board, like an organ, if you will, an organ to criticize the Jeffersonian government. So the paper was started, $10,000 of investments from other disgruntled Federalists, including about $1,000 of his own funds. The plans to make this paper were actually hatched at the farm estate of a man named Archibald Gracie.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, his house would later become Gracie Mansion, which would be the home for most every mayor of New York, except for our current one. So Hamilton then hired his first editor, whose name was William Coleman, who was basically plucked from Hamilton's own entourage. He was a lawyer that had been closely aligned with him. Coleman's first editorial, get this, he says he wants to keep the Post clear of personal virulence, low sarcasm, and verbal contentions with printers and editors.
I think the Post has done a fabulous job of upholding that principle.
Oh, no. I mean, within a month, he's arguing in print with other editors at another newspaper. And Coleman is a firebrand. In 1803, he's in a duel, and he actually kills New York Harbor Master, who had said something disparaging to Coleman. So he shoots him and kills him in a duel, goes back, and they put out the newspaper, and he apologizes because it's 30 minutes late.
Did he include the piece about the murder?
Probably not in that edition, at least.
But speaking of duels, I mean, what happened to Hamilton? Because if he created the paper, launched it, in 1801?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's sad because he didn't really get to use it as the mouthpiece that he wanted to, because, you know, he ends up dying on July 22nd, 1804. So he's not really alive that much to really use it. Coleman himself, though, does keep the paper running until 1829, but then he has a stroke. And he can't continue. But luckily, at that time, there was another editor running the paper who then retained ownership of it. And his name is William Cullen Bryant.
A famous man. He actually controlled the paper for, the next 50 years?
He gave it its first real success and turned it into a powerful piece of journalism.
And he was something of a renegade, too. I mean, he was an abolitionist. He was a poet, among other things.
He's often been compared to Benjamin Franklin and how he was able to shape political opinion using journalism in this newspaper.
Which, I guess, was Hamilton's intention in starting the paper.
Most significantly, it was not any of these actual policies, but in the 1840s, Mr. Bryant had just declared that what New York needed was a gigantic public park that was similar to these English parks. Mm. So he ran a competition in his newspaper, receiving over 60 entries of how to design this grand park. So the winning entry Tom, if you remember from last week's episode, the winning entry was Olmsted and Vos. Well, and he was ahead of his time in a lot of these things, including, Tom, did you realize that he was actually one of the founders of the Republican Party?
Of
the original Republican Party, that's correct. You know, he was actually a old school Democrat, I don't want to get into the specifics and the nuances of like partisanship right now, but the party
save
that was
the emails, folks.
He was a key in the formation of the original Republican Party in 1856. The paper then developed this Republican slanted voice, being an abolitionist, and like Henry Ward Beecher, who down in, on his pulpit was proclaiming the evils of slavery and a lot of these sort of outrageous things to us today. He took this drastic sides of abolition. He ran editorials, for instance, proclaiming John Brown as like a martyr. Now, I know I keep returning every podcast now. It's almost a cliche now of returning to Abraham Lincoln at Cooper Union, but I have to return to him now because Bryant was such a huge Lincoln proponent, and Lincoln himself had such an admiration towards Bryant that he introduced Lincoln at that very infamous speech that Lincoln made that basically helped get him elected. And then Lincoln then turned to Bryant on stage and said, "It was worth a journey to the East merely to see such a man." So, he was the publisher of the newspaper, and he was, at this time, he was doing things like translating the Iliad and the Odyssey and everything. I mean, he was an absolutely fantastic, literate man.
Probably the most famous of the post-19th century editors. And he stuck around, as we said, for 50 years. So, till about, 1881, when the title was handed over to Henry Villard.
Yeah, so Bryant died in 1878, and then at 1881, here comes Henry, and the Villard family.
Now, Henry was a German-born immigrant to the U.S. He was a political progressive. He was a trained journalist, had worked at a couple different newspapers in the U.S., but made a fortune in the railroad. He went ahead and took control in 1881 and also bought into The Nation. Did you know this?
The Nation? Like
The Nation, that's today's magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
But then write the newspaper. He would do a number of things during his amazing time here in New York, also helping to finance Edison's early projects.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
he was all over the place.
He helped him establish the Edison General Electric Company in 1889.
Do you know that he was also married to the daughter of William Lloyd Garrison, who basically is like the abolitionist figure of the 19th century?
And Henry stayed as the progressive editor and force behind the New York Evening Post up until 1897, because in 1897 he handed control to his son Oswald Garrison Villard, and who was also a political radical, thankfully.
And very, very virulently anti-war in a period when we were in a war, the Spanish-American War.
And would remain, right, he would remain that way throughout his lifetime, in fact, controversially, later on, to the detriment, perhaps, of the Evening Post. But Oswald, first of all, he became the owner, actually, in 1900, of the Evening Post and of The Nation when his father died. And then was one of the founding members of the NAACP.
Oh, right. He even put free advertisements. He gave just free space in the paper advertising this in 1910. That's really extraordinary.
And also the ACLU. He was one of the founding members and was also writing editorials and pushing for women's suffrage. Yes. I mean,
he's almost like a proto civil rights leader in a strange way.
Well,
whatever his motivations were. I mean, he put his name and he participated and gave so much publicity and attention to these groups that are, of course, really important to us today.
And also was fighting for pacifist causes and against America's involvement in World War I.
But that's where he got into a little bit of trouble, was his anti-war stance during World War I. Isn't that correct?
Well, following the war, right, there were allegations that he was actually pro-German during the war.
He was a German. His father had lived in Germany. So
the Post suffered a fallout from advertisers. So this was a difficult period. It actually forced Oswald to sell the paper, though he held on, not surprisingly, to The Nation, which remained his unwavering mouthpiece the way up through the rest of his life.
The Post at this time, then, it's entering a slump phase. And, you know, it's almost symbolic that he would sell it at this time anyway, because it's sort of a rapid succession of owners at this particular time.
Should we cue the montage music?
Yeah, montage. Yes.
Now, this is the part in the movie, you know, where they have the headlines falling, you know, the
swirling headlines on the side, and my head will be in the middle.
Give them to me.
Well, so he sold the paper in 1918 to a J.P. Morgan investor named Thomas Lamont, mm-hmm. who was also fairly liberal for the time, and he was a leader in the women's rights movement. He was not able to see profit for this, and so he sold it at a loss of reportedly $2 million in 1924 to a group of reform leaders, actually like a group of businessmen. It was headed by Cyrus H.K. Curtis, who was a publisher of the Ladies' Home Journal, and I think you may see where this is going, and also the Saturday Evening Post. The New York Post at this Evening Post at this time becomes very stodgy and unsensational, essentially boring. And by the way,
had it been sensational before? Because I thought it was progressive.
Progressive, but it was interesting. Maybe not sensational, but during this time, it is decidedly not sensational.
So it was a big snooze.
Yes. By the way, I should mention that one of the reform leaders that happened to buy into this paper at this period of time, one Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Ding,
believe
ding.
It or not. So anyway, the paper was slipping even further into popularity, just wasn't working. So then in 1934 to 1939, it was sold to a new owner by the name of J. David Stern, who also owned a Philadelphia paper called the Philadelphia Record. He was the one that drops the Evening, so now we can just call it the New York Post from here on out. He was so anti-German, anti-Nazi, because this is like the years leading up to World War II, anti-Nazi, that he barred advertisements from companies and department stores that sold German products. And so who topped that list but New York's biggest department store, Macy's. And so he barred ads from them for a time. But, well, with this sort of philosophy, paper's still not going to be successful. And what happened, it was actually a money pit. It was taking money away from his Philadelphia paper, which was making money. So he sold it in 1939.
But then it switches hands for perhaps the most important time in the 20th century. Well, that's debatable, but first really important time, landing in the hands of Dorothy Schiff, who is just an incredible character.
She really is. I mean, she is, in every sense of the word, fabulous. In every sense.
You heard it here, folks. She purchased it in 1939, and she would run the paper for the next 40 years, continuing, perhaps restoring the paper's liberal theme and progressive-minded slants in politics.
Well, bringing back both its popularity and then bringing back its liberal philosophies, if you will. The New York Times, by the way, called her, like, this is a description of her, they called her both flirt and boss, frosty heiress and labor champion. Dorothy was from a very rich banking family. She was upper-class New York debutante. An old school FDR style Democrat. She was really into these welfare organizations like the Henry Street Settlement. Her second husband, by the name of George Backer, thanks to the social circle that he was in, she was included in a lot of the Algonquin Round Table.
Mm-hmm. So she's plugged in.
So anyway, so she owns a paper. She makes her husband, who was a city councilman, we just said George Backer was his name. She makes him the publisher and editor. Now, it didn't do so well for the first year. It lost $2 million. And basically in the early days, it's reported that she threw about one third of her total net worth into the paper just to keep it afloat.
This is becoming a familiar story, isn't it? It seems like the Post has become something of a money pit for people who want to get their voices heard. Political leanings out there.
But in this case, it manages to work despite the fact that she has these sort of, let's just say, domestic disputes throughout the whole thing.
I guess that's to be expected when you name your husband publisher and editor.
In 1942, her husband resigns, and then she actually steps in and becomes, for what it's time, the very first female newspaper editor for any newspaper in New York, which I find amazing. And then she divorces him behind the scenes. In 1943, her new husband, mm-hmm. brand new husband, whose name is Ted Thackeray, she makes him a co-editor and co-publisher with her.
So I got to diagram this. So Dorothy's third husband becomes her second editor.
Yes, exactly.
Her sort of second editor thrice removed.
By the way, Thackeray is credited with actually coming up with the idea of turning the paper into a tabloid size from the regular broadsheet.
Well, I have to object here because actually the first tabloid move had happened under Cyrus Curtis in 1924.
But it got switched back.
Well, right. But he had tried it out as tabloid size first in the 20s, but then it was brought back under Stern in the 30s to a broadsheet. And then Thackeray makes it a tabloid again. So it's been all over the place.
Now, Thackeray doesn't stay around that much longer. Anyway, I find this amazing. This is like a Tracy Hepburn kind of a situation here. So they have this open paper rivalry of who to support for president in the 1948 election. And I guess they're at the Democratic primaries themselves. And Thackeray wanted a man named Henry Wallace. Schiff wanted a man named Thomas Dewey. They duel openly in the paper, but then I guess there was some undercurrent here that was actually in their own personal life, because he ends up leaving the paper and then they divorce. And then what's funny is then neither of their candidates even win the presidency, because then, you know, Harry Truman comes in and wins.
Oh, that's an irony with newsprint all over it.
That is like airing out your dirty laundry in the most public forum possible.
She had, you know, other fabulous ambitions happening at the same time. She set up the Paris Post, in fact, in 1945, which lasted only until 1948, but it was only the second English newspaper being published in Paris.
Oh.
And, you know, because she had run out of husband editors, she had to start naming some other people editors. So let's see, who was next on the hit parade?
Editors like James Welshler and then Paul San.
During the Schiff years, I think the paper was, as you already said, devoted to liberalism and to unions and to Democratic candidates who didn't necessarily win. It was the only New York paper to support Adlai Stevenson during, you know, his Democratic run for president in both 1952 and 1956 against Eisenhower.
She's not really backing winners, is she? But, you know, I have to mention, though, by the 50s, the paper is making money. It's in the black, finally, you know. She even writes her own column in the 50s called Dear Readers. I think it was one of these, like, from the desk of the publisher type of things. I'm sure it was amazing.
We should dig up some of those.
You know, she had so many amazing columnists that she hired, like Elsa Maxwell and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Max Lerner. Even Pete Hamill.
Though she wasn't a traditional feminist, she didn't end up hiring more women in her office than any other newspaper. She also brought in a little sunshine into the paper, if you will. She brought the comic strips. She brought more feature-friendly stories into the paper. Significantly, though, she was not a big fan of Joseph McCarthy, and get this, she was the first vocal critic, she and the Post and her editors, I don't mean to say just her, first vocal critic of Robert Moses.
Oh, there he is. Greg, I forgot about him.
Because, you know, he was sort of considered a bit of a savior for the city. And he, you know, he was doing a lot of good things, but then there were these undercurrents of like destroying slums and everything. And so she really called him out on that. And one of the first voices to really do so.
And that makes sense, because as we learned in the Washington Square podcast, one of the most vocal critics of Moses was Eleanor Roosevelt, who was also then a columnist for
right
Schiff.
Here. Yeah, I'm sure they were good friends. And had a lot to talk about over cocktails.
It's kind of amazing to think what the Post would be like today if she had never sold out as she did in 1976.
Yeah, when she was 73 years old, and to the total surprise of her newsroom, did you know this? That she didn't tell anybody. They basically found out that their newspaper had been sold when they read it in the rival paper the next day.
Daily News?
The Daily News, and I think it was in the New York Times too. It was actually two rival newspapers. Yeah, so the paper was beginning to slightly lose money by the mid-70s, so that's when she decided to sell it, and she ended up dying in 1989, so she didn't really get to see the real direction that her newspaper goes when she sells it to
Rupert Murdoch. Now, she sold it for $31 million. Now, even under Murdoch, for a number of years, she stayed on as an advisor to Murdoch, a paid advisor.
Oh.
Though, I don't think she really did that much advising, because under Murdoch, the political leanings of the newspaper swung straight to the right, and the tone came over to the right. It became much more conservative. There was a change of tone also as he applied his sensational screamer-style headlines, his sensational brand of journalism that he had been developing.
He sort of inherits this sensational style from his early days in Australia. His father owned some tabloids, but had to sell them off. Rupert inherits the passion to own papers and to sort of get his own sort of political slants through these papers that he owns. He makes a name for himself actually in England and popularizes these sort of scandal sheets. So his first day in the office, and the first January 3rd, 1977, he introduces two things to the Post that are actually quite significant and are still there and are, they make the identity of the New York Post.
Namely?
The first one being that red stripe that runs along the top.
Ah,
that's,
yes.
That's his or his people, his, you know, the people that he brought in. That's their little clever little branding trick that they did.
And it would stand out, of course, because as opposed to today's newspapers, which are in full color. Certainly on the front page, mm-hmm. at the time, the Post and the other papers were in black and white. So yeah. A big, bold strip of red across the top.
But it's still there, and it's still identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Also on that same day came the very first Page Six, which, you know, derived from that London style gossip. The first gossip, some of the gossip items on that very first Page Six. There was a little item of Woody Allen canoodling with a young girlfriend at Elaine's.
Uh-huh.
There was some gossip about Dorothy Hamill carrying on with Dean Martin's son. So those are just
a
sampler.
Wow, a heavy-hitting news day.
The headlines get bigger. The stories get shorter.
The pieces get juicier.
You know, there's no topless women, but there are lots and lots of sexy clothed women mixed in with the regular news up in the front few pages.
And it works.
Like, for instance, in March 1977, in 1 month, it featured over 20 stories about Farrah Fawcett Majors.
You know, I think the Post still feature stories about
at least one or two, right?
So the post is a smash, but media regulation laws, if we jump ahead to the late 80s, and I apologize because it'd be much more fun to talk about Farrah Fawcett stories, but laws being what they were in 88, media regulation laws forced Murdoch to sell off some of his properties because he had, you know, he was owning TV channels and newspapers around the country, and he had to let some of the properties go. So he sold off the New York Post, mm-hmm. and it didn't really work out so well. He sold it to real estate developer Peter Calico, who declared bankruptcy in 1993.
Murdoch owns the paper now. What happened?
Well, because it went kind of back and forth. I mean, after Calico went to Stephen Hoffenberg, who was, I think, convicted, and then Abe Hirschfeld, who owned parking lots. Garages.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of a mess there for a little bit. Finally, public officials persuaded the FCC to actually issue a waiver for Murdoch so that he could bypass this law and actually own the Post along with all of his other properties. And they relented and he took up leadership again. And so that's why Murdoch owns the Post today.
That's why he still has it. That's
how he got it back.
Well, we should end this on a lighter note and just sort of give you some of our maybe not funniest headlines, just goes to show you like the style that formed in the late 70s and now with the Murdoch Post. You know, in the 70s, during the New York blackout, mm-hmm. for instance, when they were able to print out a paper like the next day, they actually got criticized by everyone in the press and the city when they came out with a paper that said 24 hours of terror and then followed by a city ravaged.
It's so dramatic. It's so believable today.
Well, yeah, that's almost like calm that today. And then shortly thereafter with the Son of Sam killer.
Same summer,
they put out a headline that said, "No one is safe from Son of Sam."
Okay, sensationalist, but you want to read the story.
Yeah, well, it's true. I'd want to pick it up, and then I'd lock myself in my house.
You know, everybody has their own favorite headline. And in fact, if you go to the Post website today, you can vote for your favorite headline. They only offer a couple of them.
They're in on the joke.
They're totally in. They're putting out a book right now. Mm-hmm. It came out on March 25th, 2008.
I saw it. I'm by it. It looks great.
All the best Post headlines. One of my favorite is about Brooke Astor's son, who was, you know, trying to run off with the family fortune. Bad air day. It's great. That was from February 8th of this year. And of course, they included a photo of his hair blowing in the wind. Mm-hmm. He looks like a disaster. Greg, I mean, the most famous headline.
Oh, headless body in topless bar, or topless body in a headless bar?
Headless body in topless bar. From April 15th, tax day, 1983. Probably the most famous headline in tabloid history. It was about a woman who was actually forced to buy a gunman to decapitate the owner of a tavern.
Gross. So, I mean, it's the headline isn't wrong.
it's technically correct. It's just tasteless.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to close our New York Post. As always, please check out our blog, BoweryBoysPodcast.com, with some pertinent stories to this podcast and all sorts of other things and pictures. And we are on Facebook. If you are on Facebook, we are also on Facebook.
We'll meet you on Facebook.
So just type in Bowery Boys and click on Become a Fan, and we have a great community on there already, and come join us there. We have some extra little features there, and we will add more as we progress.
But it's been a great pleasure flipping through the pages of the New York Post tonight with you.
Yes, and we will, of course, in future podcasts, tackle New York's other fantastic papers. Anyway, glad to have you with us. Have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
See you next week.